Hello, I'm Andy Burnham and welcome to Sparks. This week, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Sound engineers who are sampling mad. Women's wireless. The early years of Capital Radio. Programming your video. And what next for Radio Caroline? Plus, of course, your letters. It's Sparks on Radio Fax. Thanks to Thomas Hood, who's writing from East Lothian in Scotland. I listen to your station on a Sony 2001D with a whip aerial, he writes.
Cuddly Capital 539, an article about the early days of Capital Radio when it started on 557 kHz. In the broadcaster. It was the summer of 1973. Michael Bucht, the program controller, would take the team of DJs, which included Dave Simmons, Roger Scott, Tommy Vance, Joan Shenton and Nicky Horn, to various studios in London to practice. It was here that Bucht, a stocky, bearded gentleman in his 30s, with an authoritarian air complemented with a voice to match, would generally shout at the DJs and attempt to knock them into shape, a shape that he desired. Capital somehow had to be different, and Bucht knew what he wanted. Wrong or right, he intended to get the station sounding the way he perceived it should. The emphasis being on the one-to-one presenter-to-listener contact, the intimate friend. This probably explains why the jocks weren't jocks. They were presenters. Pretentious, maybe, but there was, and still is, a preconceived image people have of jocks. This was not what Bucht wanted, and at Capital in 1973, the jocks were presenters. To some of the presenters, it was only rock and roll, but to Bucht and the Capital management team, Capital was not going to be simply a commercial radio station that pulled in the bucks and played the hits. It was going to be something more substantial, a service that would be respected by the community and set an example for commercial radio to come. High ideals, but no one seemed to think it was not possible. In the temporary accommodation, 30 or so staff spent the day milling around, half of them shuffling bits of paper and not really having a clue what they were supposed to be doing. Hours would be spent designing a piece of paper that would slip into insignificance under a desk to be forgotten. Days passed by timing records and ordering product as presenters talked about this new station that all London would be listening to. For them, the only positive part of the week was going to a studio where they would pretend to be on the radio and get beaten up by Bucht, who would criticise links, shout Segway, and praise the odd link of which he approved. Just weeks before going on air, the Piccadilly premises were vacated. Everyone was moved to the Euston Tower, which was still littered with builders, decorators, electricians and engineers. This was to be the biggest commercial radio station in the world, but in the summer of 1973 it was little more than a building site. The stone floor corridors, covered in plaster dust and brightly coloured offcuts from cables, led around the first floor of the tower to the half-finished studios, where engineers had their heads buried in ducts and trunking. In the sparse offices, people were moving in their belongings. They were still shuffling papers, although by this time they had become accomplished at the art and looked as if they were actually doing something. Meanwhile, desks were moved into a vast open-plan office overlooking the Euston Road, an office that became affectionately known as the Playpen. It was here that programming staff began putting together material for the very first programmes. And with just a few weeks to go, it was an exciting time. It was also unlike any other launch of an independent station. It had to be. After all, this was only the second commercial station in the country, LBC having gone on air just weeks before. The programming was ambitious, to say the least, with a drama department, talks, documentaries, live music sessions, classical concerts, and all sprinkled with names like Dirk Bogarde, who presented his personal choice of music each weekend. This involved him putting the links onto a cassette recorder and posting it to London, where it became a pile of grief for an engineer to piece it together with records. The quality was appalling. Richard Attenborough supplemented the sparse record collection in the library with records from home, predominantly music from shows and film soundtracks. And the two staff spent the day cataloguing the expanding collection. By the beginning of October, the dry runs had begun. The presenters sat in the master control room, the presenter's studio still being unfinished, pretending to be on air. Bucht sat on the floor in an adjacent studio, listening, notepad in hand. Dressed in a brown corduroy jacket, with unkempt curly hair, he sprawled on the floor, occasionally making notes, occasionally shouting. He knew what he wanted and intended to get there. He was controlling this circus, and everyone knew it. There was little room for discussion, for airing points of view. The news was on. The reader queued into a report that had been badly recorded off a telephone line. Buck's pencil scribbled violently. Later in the day, he pointed out that the only time I want to hear a effing report recorded off a telephone line is when you've got a recording of Nixon jumping from the 42nd floor shouting, "I did it." The reporter got the message. The dry runs were followed by more dry runs, and staff were now almost living at the Euston Tower. In the evening, someone would go to the Indian, and large pots of curry would appear in the room that eventually was to become the canteen. It was help yourself. By October the 16th, the building was still unfinished. But thankfully, these studios were. The great day arrived. There were those who stayed all night, and those that trooped in the early hours of the morning. The corridors, by this time, carpeted with temporary carpet squares. By 4 a.m., people were chattering away with excitement, while on 539 and 95.8, the IBA's tape of library music mercilessly churned on. By 5 a.m., it was replaced by the national anthem. There followed a second silence, and Richard Attenborough's voice informed the odd milkman and paperboy who had accidentally stumbled upon 539, "This, for the very first time, is Capital Radio." Blue Mink burst into song. "Isn't it good to know, Capital Radio? You can turn on a friend, you can turn on a show." The George Martin-produced jingle package segue into Bridge Over Troubled Water, and Capital Radio was born. In the music studio, the champagne corks popped, and the bubbly liquid was mixed with orange juice as the multi-million-pound project had at last ejaculated. In the Euston Tower, Dave Simmons' voice could be heard in every office, on every transistor, on every desk. London was listening for the very first time to Capital Radio, or everyone felt it was. The fact is, the event, to the vast majority of Londoners, passed unnoticed. And as the sun struggled up on that misty October morning, the vast majority of Londoners were listening to Noel Edmonds, as usual. But at Broadcasting House, they were listening, and later in the day asked for comment from the odd newspaper that showed interest. One cynic was quoted as saying, "Radio 1.5. But at that time, there was no benchmark for commercial radio at all. There were the American services, which were impossible to emulate due to the restrictions laid down by the IBA. So Capital sounded like a BBC local station, laden with features, short drama, documentaries and interviews. The only real difference being there were commercials, a rather expensive jingle package, and station output littered with star names. As the first weeks passed, insecurity soon replaced euphoria. Staff spent time speculating, discussing the future, and criticising. As the day moved over to evening, groups of people gathered in various offices throughout the first floor of the Euston Tower and had a drink or two while discussing the station. Politics were raising their head, and it wasn't long before the friction began. On the morning show, which was presented by Tommy Vance and Joan Shenton, the happy couple, now having passed the honeymoon stage, were bitching. Not on air, but it was getting close. It was obviously becoming a struggle for Tommy Vance, who was more into rock and roll radio, to listen to Joan Shenton, a presenter who favoured items of reportage nature, to witter on about babies to a woman in Ealing who wanted to exchange her baby buggy for an electric toaster on the swap shop, a regular feature of the show. More about the beginnings of Capital Radio after this record.
Yeah. Sans la pluie comme un été anglais, tant les notes d'une chanson lointaine, sortant de derrière un poster, espérant que la vie ne soit pas si longue.
Continue with a piece about the beginnings of Capital Radio in 1973, Cuddly Capital 539 from the broadcaster. It was also becoming apparent that some of the staff hadn't a clue what they were doing. A fact that was beginning to show on the various weekend programmes, the majority of which were recorded and would underrun, overrun, or in one or two cases be transmitted unedited. It wasn't long before the odd F-word went to air. Sadly, the first one being one of the most prestigious talks programmes. Then came the changes. Roger Scott replaced Dave Simmons on Breakfast, Simmons filling the drive-time slot vacated by Scott. A then rather demure-sounding Roger Scott delivered Breakfast with the help of Monty Modlin, who spent his time out and about in London with a producer who spent all her time trying to get him to shut up and come out on time. He seldom did, and Scott on more than one occasion pulled the fader down on him. As the winter of 1973 began, there was concern. Outside the Euston Tower in the real world, there were petrol shortages, a three-day week, and power cuts. Edward Heath wasn't hitting it off with the unions, and it was a depressing time. In the tower, clandestine meetings were taking place. Senior staff hurried up and down corridors, to and from meetings conducted behind closed doors. There were also meetings held outside the building, an ominous sign of things going wrong. Capital Radio had not set the world alight. In fact, Capital Radio was boring. It lacked excitement and, more importantly, as a consequence, was not bringing in the advertising revenue. For people who wanted drama, there was Radio 4. For light entertainment, Radio 2. And pop provided by Radio 1. The Capital listener had to be someone who was manic to attempt to keep up with all the shots at different ill-fitting bits of programming. But these were early days, days bogged down with rules and regulations. Needle time was restricted. Live music sessions had to be recorded. There was an obligation to broadcast religion and drama. A far cry from today. Commercial radio was still obliged to give the listener what bureaucracy felt the listener wanted. But in a commercial environment, the listener has clout. No ratings, no advertising, no advertising, no radio station. Capital was attempting to be all things to all people and was becoming nothing to anyone. The staff were speculating as to what would be next. The pioneers had come into contact with the real world and the axe was to fall. The newsroom was first. Ron Onions, the head of news, along with the best part of the team, were paid off. It was becoming apparent that all London wanted was rock and roll. After all, rock and roll presented by people larger than life. It was all very well being a friend to the listener, but this friend was of the variety that you would go to great lengths to avoid at a party. By the end of the year, Capital had a new image, Cuddly Capital, with Kenny Everett and Dave Cash on The Breakfast Show. The station was effectively relaunched. Promotions were played literally every 20 minutes throughout the day for the Kenny Cash Breakfast Show, promotions that were made by Everett. Capital was sounding like Radio Kenny Everett, but it was beginning to work. People were beginning to sample the station. This, for many, was Capital Radio for the very first time. With Kenny Everett on The Breakfast Show, Dave Cash moved to lunchtime, and Michael Aspel on the morning programme. Capital Radio began to pull an audience. For the first time, the station was beginning to be heard in restaurants and shops around London. The music had also changed. Gone was the middle-of-the-road, polished-sounding format. Capital had a massive injection of glam rock and glitter. In the space of just months, the station had gone from a quality music first policy, with presenters second, to using upfront named presenters, interspersed with Gary Glitter and Mud. This lady was foreturning, but it was working. Slowly, drama disappeared, along with Monty Modlin, and the patchwork quilt of weekend talk and features programmes. Just the classical music programme, alternatives, the arts programme, and Mardi Gras remained in the coming years. Capital was at last beginning to work. Michael Aspel, after a sticky start adapting to self-operation, up to this point in his life he had always had a BBC technical operator, settled in and even managed to wean himself of the BBC headphones that were specially adapted because he was so used to them. By 1975, Capital was claiming an audience of 1.1 million each weekday. Kenny Everett's share of the available listeners was 8%, while Aspel achieved 12%. Both programmes attracted a slightly down-market audience. But by this time, Capital was becoming established. But the everyday routine of The Breakfast Show was beginning to bore Everett, who would present the programme and at the same time play patience with a pack of playing cards. And the morning arrived when he wasn't there. He attempted suicide. I woke up and was surrounded by all these people who were dressed in white, and I thought it was heaven. But I was in hospital, he was quoted as saying. Various replacements filled the hole while the problem was resolved. Eventually, when Graham Dean took over and remained on Breakfast throughout the 70s and into the 80s, during which time Capital continued to grow. And in spite of setbacks, none as monumental as the launch and subsequent relaunch in those early days, Capital today is the biggest commercial radio station in the world. Many of the staff from those early days of Capital have moved on. Sue Cook, who used to present the shopping basket on the Aspel programme, moved on to a career in television, as did Pam Armstrong, who also presented the same feature. Aspel himself moving on some years later. The list is endless, but there are few of the original staff who will recall those early days in Piccadilly. Kenny Everett, Dave Cash and Dave Simmons, who all rejoined the Gold Service. Peter Jackson, the chief engineer, Mike Childs, one of the senior producers, Peter Ockerford and a handful of others, all of whom will be able to recall the days of Capital 539, possibly with affection. They will also recall around 18 years ago, John Whitney, then managing director, arranged for a time capsule to be constructed and inserted into the wall of the reception area of Capital. In it was placed trivia like parking tickets and a programme schedule. A photograph was taken of those present at the sealing ceremony. The capsule will be opened in 7 years. Roger Scott, sadly, is just one person who will not be at the opening. But in the meantime, the programme schedule looks like this. Capital Radio programmes from Friday, November the 23rd, 1973. 6 o'clock in the morning. Music and Roger Scott. With news, weather checks, Monty Modlin and surprise packages. 9 a.m. Music with Tommy Vance and Joan Shenton with Swap Shop when listeners phone to swap goods. 10:05 a.m. She and Me, a 5-minute serial starring Lewis Maxwell, and music. 10 a.m. Dapple Downs, a new serial with Adrian Corrie. Midday, music with Dave Cash and Cash Countdown, a phone-in competition for big prizes. At 2 p.m. on Capital, it was music with Tony Myatt and the listener's talent spot. At 2:15, The Courtesans, a new historical serial, and at 4 p.m, The Bedsitter, starring Peggy Mount. 4:15 p.m, Dave Simmons with music and the latest travel and traffic news. At 5:55, Honey Adair, radio's first strip cartoon. Good grief. At 6 p.m, London's Day with Sue Denny and Simon Preble, summing up today and exploring tomorrow. 6:30 p.m, Your Mother Wouldn't Like It, Nicky Horn's rock show with Flatshare and special guests. And 8:30 p.m, Open Line with Alan Hargreaves, a phone-in for advice, argument and comment. Capital's programmes, November 1973.
Oh, leaves are brown.
Couple of articles from Audio Media. If you thought you had some strange friends, well, have a listen to this. A recent film which can't have failed to come to your attention is Peter Greenaway's Prospero's Books, based on Shakespeare's play The Tempest, and starring John Gielgud as Prospero. If you haven't seen it yet, even if art movies are not to your taste, you owe it to yourself to experience the rich visual texture achieved with the aid of high-definition video techniques, which is just one of the delights the film has to offer. The sound on Prospero's Books is interesting too, with much of the work on dialogue and sound effects having been done at Hackenbacher Studio. If you're thinking that the name sounds familiar but can't quite place its derivation, think of Gerry Anderson's Thunderbirds. Hiram H. Hackenbacher is none other than the bright chap with the big spectacles. Brains. Hackenbacher's involvement with Peter Greenaway started several years ago on The Belly of an Architect. On Prospero's Books, Hackenbacher's role was in manipulating the dialogue, which is far from conventional in its presentation, and creating sound effects. For the latter, Nigel will either modify sound library effects or think of a weird and or wonderful way of producing something new. If we haven't got an effect, we go out and shoot it, but I think that if you haven't shot it yourself, I would bet a pound to a penny that you're going to have to manipulate it in some way to make it work. It's very rare that you can see something that is mute on the screen, make a list of what you need, go and get it from a library, and find that the effect works every time. I hate using library effects. If I needed a hand clap, I would much rather have a bloke go in the booth and clap his hands, rather than search through a library, which I think is a waste of time. Samplers are great for creating those noises. For the weirder Greenway-esque type of stuff, the Akai S1000 is magic. There is one noise that we used quite a bit. I ripped apart a Tandy PZM microphone and stuck it inside an old toaster, like you do. I just moved the toaster around and stuck the sound in the S1000, messed around with it, and made the most weird stereo ambience. That's the fun part. If you've got a microphone and a booth, you can make whatever noise you want. Prospero's books features some underwater sequences where I wanted to make a noise that sounded like whales, but not just using any old library whale sound. I wanted to make it sound like the whale was sitting right next to you, talking to you. The best way we found to do it was to get the sound of a gibbon, run it into the audio file, and use VariSpeed. Well, the article continues, but I think you get the picture. And another article in Audio Media, the recently released Poolside Drums CD gives sampler owners access to a huge selection of drum and percussion sounds, with a difference. They were recorded on location within the confines of a 1.5 million cubic foot capacity swimming pool. London Sample Workshop founder Tom McLaughlin and session drummer Neil Huxtable talk to Audio Media about sampling, swimming pools, and foam rubber. Well, the foam rubber first. Talking to Tom, it was a toss-up at school whether to pursue a career in music or puppets and sculpting, and I happened to win a full scholarship to study sculpture at art college. That solved that. I dropped out in the first year and started working for a marionette company making puppets for commercials, and never too far from recording, produced pre-recorded backing tapes for shows. A few years later, I was asked to work for the Muppets. I was really into latex. No, not the way you think. As a flexible casting material. Fascinated by it. Being in the right place at the right time, it turned out that Henson Associates was about to embark on a film project like no other. The Dark Crystal, that would rely on vast quantities of foam latex to realise its three-dimensional animatronic characters. I'd already been making Miss Piggy heads out of foam rubber for The Muppet Show when pre-production started on the Dark Crystal project, but relying on ready-made foam rubber kits left much to be desired, as did standard plaster moulds, which fell apart after several cure cycles. At that point, the mad scientist in me came to the forefront, and I proceeded to research and develop a new grade of latex foam, and moulding and casting techniques more suited to the puppets and beasties at hand, rather than the beds, car seats, and the odd makeup appliance previously manufactured from the material. My formulations and techniques are still in common use throughout the film industry. Jim Henson was an incredibly forward-thinking man, and gave all of his employees enough creative space to develop new materials and techniques. So on to the drum sampler. The advent of cheap DSP techniques 5 or 6 years ago made a lot of people think that live recording rooms would be an extinct species by now. Of course, that hasn't proved to be the case. A good live room is as popular as ever. Digital reverb isn't the be-all and end-all we thought it would become. I can't see the sense in recording samples with artificial ambience when everybody and their brother has a digital reverb of some sort or another at home. I knew that I wanted to do some big drums in a real acoustic space that was a little bit out of the ordinary. I'd toyed around in an automotive warehouse at night, and also listened to a few other large industrial-type places. A mate of mine, Smarty, lives just around the corner from the Janet Agoke Leisure Centre, formerly the White City Swimming Baths. One day we were working on some reggae tracks at his place, and when he had to pick his daughter up from her swimming session, I trotted along. As soon as we were inside the building, I clapped my hands, and this huge smile crossed my face. It was at that moment I realised that this was the place. I'd love to record a heavy metal band there. There's this mezzanine that we immediately realised was the obvious place to record from. It's a balcony, roughly halfway between the surface of the pool and the ceiling, that just about comes out to the pool, so we were a good distance from the main walls of the building and about 8 feet above the water. Well, the article continues with more drum lunacy and rounds up, the whole poolside drum project really turned me on to the idea of recording in genuine environments as opposed to studios. Although we'll never rule out studio recordings, how about car parks, caves or subways in the middle of the night? String quartets or early keyboard instruments in stately mansions? There are so many possibilities and people aren't even scratching the surface. But the workshop is about much more than location recordings of drums. It's about bringing fresh, new, musically useful sounds to the sampling musician.
go to bed. Never seems to come to be a guest now in a sad dream. From a hillside, they come in the trees, a silver tongue, like a I'm fighting gravity falling. My daddy won't let them get me. A voice screams.
If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofax Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck, and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and 4 stars in the Radio Netherland receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England, 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England, 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
Here's something from Bob Tomalski from the BBC. Now, Bob used to be on Radio FX occasionally, in particular in 1988, quite often. And this is something he did for Woman's Hour on BBC Radio 4, talking about how difficult it is to program video recorders.
And there seems to be a general trend to make things as complicated as possible.
So you feel you have to be a computer operator in order
very
to do
much
it.
So.
What types of people, looking at research that's been done, find it hard to use? Yeah.
Well, it's certainly not just women. I mean, at What Video, we get lots of phone calls from readers who ring us up and say, look, I've got the latest Hokey Cokey 2000 machine. Can you help us in programming it? And in our magazine, we've been campaigning for a long time for video recorders to be made simpler rather than more complicated. So the people that find it complicated really come from all walks of life, and they're all types of people. But one point I would make, and there's many old people think, well, a video recorder would be an ideal thing to get in retirement, but buy a video recorder and then just find it's just too complicated to use.
Why are they so unuser-friendly?
Well, there are lots of reasons for that. I mean, they're all basically black boxes with black buttons set back under black flaps. They're all sort of very sort of, it's difficult to identify the right button. Often there are phrases on the front panel that are just meaningless. Lots of words, I mean, you can understand fast forward and rewind, but things like frame advance and prog and timer delay and shuttle jog and terms of this sort are just, unfriendly.
What are the manufacturers doing? Do they care?
Well, yes, manufacturers do care, or they say they care. I've got something here in front of us, actually, which is the handset from a video recorder. Just have a listen to this.
Let's set the timer for recording. Press the program button.
This is the handset from a Sharp video recorder that came on the market a few years ago. It's no longer available, and the manufacturers thought that the one way in which they would simplify recording is to have a handset with what's called a speech synthesizer built into it. So they've come out with this very large handset that's about the size of a paperback book. And there's actually a little Japanese lady in here that talks you through setting your machine.
On what day and month do you wish to report? Press the number buttons to program the day.
And the idea is you go through and you push buttons to enter the day, the time, the month, the channel and the duration of the recording.
She's terrifying, though. I mean,
absolutely. And that's why it didn't succeed. The machine was on the market for about a year. The price dropped and dropped and dropped, and it was finally taken off the market.
So what is actually working? You've got another one here, a remote controller.
Well, this is an idea of what some of the manufacturers are doing now to simplify controls. This is a remote control from Sony, and it's actually a remote from a video recorder and TV all in one. And if we look at it, it's quite a large remote, but it's got 60 buttons on it. 60 buttons. But for those that don't need all the functions, you operate a catch, take it out of its sleeve, and put it round the other way, and now you've got about 25 buttons.
And briefly, Bob, when are we going to see the same technology applied to radio?
Well, that's going to come in. You can do it now. You can buy a little plug-type time switch for maybe £20 or so with an electronic display, and that could control a cheap radio cassette recorder.
And you could then record Woman's Hour if necessary and listen to it at
Absolutely.
Any time of the day or night. Bob Tomalski, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Sometime Radio Facts presenter there, Bob Tomalski, on Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4.
Hello to Roland Stenbo, writing from Enköping in Sweden. Thanks for your letter, Roland. He's listening on 6205 and remarks that the reception quality is very good indeed. He's got a long wire, 25 metres long. I'm 35 years old, and I have a wife and two daughters, 2 and 4 years old. My profession is on a local environmental protection board.
someone who gets things fixed. Ask yourself this question, do you want to be rich? I've got the brains, you've got the looks. Let's make lots of money.
This week on Sparks, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, sound engineers who are sampling mad, women's wireless, the early years of Capital Radio, programming your video, and what next for Radio Caroline. From Skeptical Inquirer, searching for extraterrestrial intelligence, an interview with Thomas R. McDonough, who's an astrophysicist and the coordinator for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI, for the Planetary Society, the largest space group in the world, with more than 100,000 members on 7 continents. Its president is Carl Sagan. So what exactly is SETI? Well, it stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and is the name used throughout the world for projects in which scientists are looking for objective, repeatable proof of the existence of civilizations elsewhere in the universe. Usually SETI is understood as the search for radio signals from other civilizations. How big is SETI, and are any other countries involved in the search? There are three main projects in the United States right now, and there are other countries involved, particularly in the Soviet Union and Canada. In Canada, for example, one researcher is now preparing the radio telescope at the Algonquin University to be used in a future search for extraterrestrial intelligence. The Soviet Union has embarked on a project that will look for radio signals. The first of the three main United States projects is at Ohio State University, and has been operational for about a decade. It's the longest-running SETI project in the world. The second is the one that NASA is building. It's not yet running, but will probably be operating in 1992, and will then be the world's most powerful SETI project. And finally, there are the ones I'm associated with, the Planetary Society SETI projects at Harvard and in Argentina. These are the most powerful SETI systems currently operating anywhere in the world. So why does McDonnell think there may be someone or something trying to communicate with us? The universe is so big that it seems very unlikely that we could be alone. The mere fact that we have several hundred billion stars in our own Milky Way galaxy, and the fact that this galaxy is just one of perhaps 100 billion other galaxies, shows the overwhelming number of places in the universe where life could exist. And the idea that we could be alone in the universe seems unlikely just on those grounds alone. But more than that, when you look at the history of life on Earth, and at what we're made of, there is nothing that seems terribly unusual when you compare the conditions on the Earth with the conditions elsewhere in the universe. For example, the Sun is not a weird star. It's not a rare star. It's one of the more common types in the universe. Or if you look at what we're made of, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, these atoms are not rare. If we were made out of platinum, for example, I might be worried about the basic ingredients for life not being widespread. But we're made out of some of the most common atoms in the universe, ones that we have detected around distant stars and in other galaxies. Sometimes scientists speculate that an older, more advanced civilization, provided there is one, would have long ago set out to colonize the universe, much like people on Earth talk about our plans to someday establish bases on the Moon and Mars. The argument goes that because we haven't seen them, they aren't here, and since they have had billions of years to reach us, that is proof that there aren't any other civilizations out there at all. Well, McDonough says, that is an interesting idea, but it contains an awful lot of hidden assumptions. One is the assumption that a civilization would want to spread like a virus throughout the entire galaxy and colonize every possible piece of real estate in sight. My suspicion is that a really advanced civilization would find so many ways to use its own solar system that it wouldn't have as great a need to colonize an entire galaxy. Now, I could be wrong, but the point, that is, it's crazy, I think, to jump to the conclusion that just because we don't see our own planet being colonized by extraterrestrial beings, it means that we are alone in the universe. That is what some people claim. With the vast amount of noise being generated from the Earth, from radio and television and such, how can you filter through all the interference? How could you hear a signal if there was one out there? Well, that's a very difficult problem, especially for the NASA system, which looks at all microwave frequencies from 1 to 10 gigahertz. But in our system, we've narrowed down the search. Paul Horovitz, the Harvard scientist who designed and built the system, proposed several years ago that we look for what we call ultra-narrow-band signals. What that means is looking for signals that are much narrower than the noise that Mother Nature produces. Nature produces signals that, even in the narrowest cases, are usually spread out over many kilohertz of frequency, very much like a radio broadcast signal on the planet Earth. And so both the artificial signals on Earth and the natural spread signals of Mother Nature are spread out over a large range of frequencies. What we do is look for very, very narrow signals. Signals that are 0.05 Hz wide. Much smaller than even normal radio station signals. By doing that, we automatically reject most sources of noise, both from nature and from our own civilization. In the Planetary Society's SETI programs, we look at around 8 million frequencies, clustered around natural frequencies, such as that of hydrogen, 1420 MHz, and hydroxyl, the OH molecule, 1700 MHz. In the NASA system, they will use larger bandwidths and cover a much larger range of frequencies. For them, it is necessary to develop software to recognize the horrendously complicated noises that our own radio, TV, radar, and satellites produce. So why does McDonough think a civilization would use these particular frequencies? The best reason would be to avoid the problem of the noisy nature that we live in. The galaxy is chock full of sources that generate noise. There are gases in space, and magnetic fields and other things that generate all kinds of noise. In fact, when you tune a radio between stations, part of that hiss that you hear is the hiss from our own galaxy. Or when you look at a television set that's not tuned to a local station, then you get snow. Part of that snow is from space. So one of the ways that one civilization could make its signal readily detectable to another civilization is by concentrating all of that energy into the narrowest possible bandwidth. And we calculate the narrowest practical bandwidth would be about 0.05 Hz. So how does he know which stars to look at when searching for radio signals? There are two different strategies. The one we used is to search the entire sky. So at Harvard, we aim the antenna at one part of the sky and we let the Earth rotate for 24 hours. That allows the antenna to see a strip of sky about half a degree wide during those 24 hours. If we don't see anything, then we raise the antenna another half degree and look at the next strip. The NASA approach is interesting because they are going to combine this kind of technique, which is called the all-sky survey, with another type called a targeted search. In a targeted search, what you do is look at stars that are similar to the Sun, because we think those are the best bets where life could arise. And so NASA will choose several thousand stars that are much like our Sun, and focus part of their effort on those stars. We couldn't actually converse with extraterrestrials if we did pick up a signal, though, could we? No, not in the sense of our saying, "Hi, how are you?" And they're responding, "Well, we're doing pretty well, how are you?" The problem is that the enormous distances that exist in the universe. It would mean that, for example, even if they are a light century away, 100 light-years away, it would take 100 years for our signal to get from here to there. And then if they replied, it would take another 100 years for that signal to get back. So it's not the kind of spirited conversation that you would like. Then what would be the benefit of receiving such a signal, of hearing from another civilization? Well, the greatest benefit would come from knowing that there is another civilization out there. Right now, without that knowledge, we tend to think of ourselves as being unique in the universe, and for people in one culture to think they are special and very different from people in another culture. So the Russians, the Chinese, and the Americans all think of themselves as being pretty different from one another. But if suddenly we had positive proof that there were some two-headed little green men in another world with a more advanced civilization, we would begin to see ourselves as a single species, in which our differences were trivial compared to the differences between us and them. So how would he summarize the arguments in favor of the search? Nobody on Earth truly knows whether we're alone or if the universe is buzzing with life. Sticking our heads in the ground never got us anywhere in science. If we don't search, we'll never find anything. If we do search, the least we'll do is explore the universe. Let's do it. That was from Skeptical Inquirer.
You out of sight. Peek-a-boo.
Women's Wireless, The Cat's Whiskers, by Anne Karpf in The Observer. On International Women's Day last March, Caroline Mitchell and Trish Cavalli were having a meal together, gloomily discussing the subject of women and radio. "Wouldn't it be amazing to have a whole station run by women?" they said. Then they both groaned with premonitory exhaustion, for they knew they'd have to start it themselves. Since then, the Radio Authority has granted them a restricted license, which allows a station to be set up around a particular event. Next year, on the eve of International Women's Day, 8th of March, Femme FM, Britain's first all-female radio station, will broadcast to metropolitan Bristol for a fortnight. "We want to show what a female sound is like," says Caroline Mitchell. With a 60-40 music-speech ratio, Femme FM will offer a daily international programme looking at women's initiatives in other cultures, an early evening arts programme and youth programmes. But will it be radio ideologically correct, a 19 hours a day crusading lament about the lot of women, or radio aren't we great with a relentlessly celebratory tone? Caroline Mitchell answers by stressing the diversity of voices and strands being planned. Comedy slots, Traffic Island discs, ordinary women choosing their favourite music, and possibly a soap opera. "And when we're asked, what about men, we can say we've got an hour for them daily," says Caroline Mitchell, referring to Men's Hour, made by the station's one male producer. Femme FM will also offer expert-free late-night phone-ins with women sharing experiences on subjects such as, inevitably, sex. "We think men will want to listen to that too," adds Caroline Mitchell. Equally important is the music played on the station. Not all of it is made by women, but it will be chosen by them. Femme FM will be free of the patronising mid-Atlantic stick. "Done your housework, going to the disco tonight," peddled by so many male DJs. Broadcasters' attitudes have moved on a little since 1973, when Capital Radio's franchise application declared that women are sentimental, women are escapist. Femme FM will give us what Radio 3 rarely has, a woman presenting jazz, along with two specialist music slots. Women DJs are few and generally marooned in the small hours. On Femme FM, there'll be centre stage. But perhaps the most exciting aspect of Femme FM is already happening off air. The project has thrown itself exuberantly into training a large number of first-time broadcasters. A core of 40 women experienced in production and mixed in age, class and ethnic background meet fortnightly. Some liaise with schools and community groups and hold public meetings to draw in volunteers. They already have 100. Femme FM has attracted other forms of practical support. A local advertising agency is devising publicity material, and the Bristol Initiative, which runs a local shopping centre, is providing free premises for a studio. Femme FM is writing to every radio journalism course in the country, encouraging female students to submit 7-minute features. At South Bristol College, where Caroline Mitchell works as a media lecturer, they've set up special courses in presentation, script writing and radio drama. Postgraduate radio journalism students from Bristol Polytechnic will provide 3 news bulletins a day. The male students can participate, but the presenters will be female, and at least one story per bulletin will be about women. Caroline Mitchell and Trish Cavalli are both experienced in working on news stations. "We know we have to do it thoroughly. You can't just set up a station on a good idea, and it's got to sound good." Femme FM will be non-profit making and without adverts. So far, only £2,000 of the £40,000 needed to put the station on air for 2 weeks has been raised. They are looking for a major sponsor, offering the carrot of on-air promotion and the cachet of being associated with Britain's first women's radio station. Smaller sponsors and other contributions are also welcome. Poster sites, mail shots and press advertisements are expensive, but all necessary to get listeners listening. Since the 1970s, most other countries have had some kind of all-woman station. From Italy's pioneering feminist Radio Donna, so threatening to the macho right that they gunned down a studio full of broadcasters, to America's one-time commercial station, WOMN1220, which banned cock rock music and emphasised news stories about women. If FemFM is successful, it might reapply for a further fortnight in 1993, and eventually for a permanent franchise. In the meantime, station heads could tune in to FemFM in March to hear what women can do when let out of the confines of a single hour. That was by Anne Karpf in The Observer about Britain's first all-female radio station to be on the air next March in Bristol.
Beam Me Up Petal in Electronics Weekly. The serrated edge of radar dishes developed at the Georgia Institute of Technology make them look strangely like flowers. But the aim is not to make military antennas and satellite dishes look more friendly. Edward Joy, a professor of electrical engineering at the Institute, said the serrations reduce unwanted side lobes in the antenna's radiation pattern. Standard round dishes have uniform electric fields across their apertures, but the field abruptly drops to zero, creating side lobes. The serrations taper the electric field to avoid this, and their shape controls the beam characteristics. Every application would have its own set of most desirable shapes, said Joy. The idea has already been used on a 75-foot antenna at the Army Electronic Proving Grounds in Arizona. The improved beam of the petal antenna could be important in civil applications such as spacing between communication satellites in geosynchronous orbit. The tighter direction would be less likely to pick up interference from adjacent satellites than conventional dishes. you're listening to Sparks on Radiofax, 6205 12255 and now 3910 for the winter to the UK. Our address is Sparks, Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. I guarantee to read your letter out on air. If you'd like a reply in writing, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. The address again, Sparks, Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. Other Radiofax programmes start on Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays. So what will become of the Ross Revenge, docked as it is somewhere in Dover, out of sight of the curious eye? It must have been a hellish storm that night. Peter Moore recently reported that the anchor chain at the bow of the ship, whilst being almost worn through, had a second intact link the other side to hold it if the first broke. The backlash of the first link breaking probably sheared the chain clean off. If the finances were so poor not to be able to have a replacement anchor chain fitted, what are the chances that the organisation can find the recovery fees that must now be due? Helicopter recovery is not cheap, and there is no insurance that I'm aware of to pick up the bills. Donations must be pouring in from the Ross Revenge support group and others. Would the authorities allow her back out to sea? There's been none of that naughty radio business going on for some time, after all. Probably more importantly to Admiralty House or whoever makes the decision is whether the legendary lost license from Panama can be found. I've heard numerous affirmations that it does exist from Peter Moore, and more stories that the Ross Revenge is an unregistered hulk with no valid documents. Recently on this programme, we've heard how shortwave listening is crisis-led. The fewer countries with oppressed populations, stifled of news from the outside, the more satellite feeds and FM relays go up, and the fewer people want to listen to shortwave. In a similar way, the more radio choice there is perceived to be in Britain, the fewer people there are willing to tune to Caroline. More choice? The medium wave band will soon be almost solely given over to gold pap, it seems. I don't call that choice. It's been a sad month for me. Two dreams of youth shattered. I wanted to bring you the Silvercrin show or whatever nonsense on Luxembourg in my past days. Now that's going as well. It was only tuning one of my valve radios that it sank in. No more dreams of crossing Europe on 208. As for Caroline, that dream became reality for a few short weeks that seemed like a lifetime. Under Rob Harrison, we strived to keep up the quality of service. News on the hour and half hour at peak times, travel, the short-lived what's on spots in that summer just before the raid. Misguided, though that format may well have been, we worked bloody hard, with the building of the new towers going on as well for those with any strength left. I probably grew up more on that ship than in a year at university. All the time that ship was out there, it felt to me like we were winning against the elements and against them. It seems cliched to repeat how the Caroline organisation always finds a way to bounce back with a new ship, new mast, or whatever. But what else can I use to end my piece? I refuse to believe this is the end. For the latest information, please do call the Caroline Newsline. There's two numbers running at the moment. The first is 0839 669 990. And at the moment, due to the special circumstances, 0839 669 944. That's 0839 669 944. Some other pirate news. In Nottingham, Globe FM has just appeared on 101 FM, playing soul, hip-hop and virtually anything but rock music, is reported. Rave FM are still there on 101.6 with dance music, and Heatwave on 98.6 playing reggae. And in Derby, you can hear Power 99 on 99.2. Thanks to Arnold Gibbon for that report.
Available now, a brand new Radio Caroline CD called The Legend Lives On. The CD contains 44 tracks taking you through some of the great events of Radio Caroline from the first broadcasts in 1964 with Simon D. Test transmissions from Caroline North with Daffy Don Allen. Tony Prince in 1966. Other great names like Robbie Dale, Crispian St. John, Andy Archer and Peter Chicago. One track features the female DJs through the 80s. And you'll hear two memorable Caroline commercials and jingles, and about the collapse of the highest shipborne aerial mast anywhere in the world in 1987, plus shortwave test transmissions in 89 and the raid in that year on the Ross Revenge. All this is just a tiny fraction of what you'll hear on The Legend Lives On, a new 44-track CD available at £9.99 inclusive, only from these sources. SMC, P.O. Box 53121 at 1007 RC, Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and from Chris Edwards, P.O. Box 1514, London W72LL in England. Radio Caroline, The Legend Lives On.